trying to take my vitamins.
Okay, everyone. I'm opening this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Wednesday, April 12th, 2017. Welcome, everyone, here. So we have a few public hearings and possible work sessions, and although, you know, I'll just say up front that we won't have the work sessions on those public hearings. I try not to do that, have a public hearing and a work session on the same day. But we have some work sessions that I'd like to get out of the way, just since miraculously everyone is here right now. I think we're ready to go with Senate Bill 418. So let me announce, among these work sessions, I'm going to be carrying over Senate Bill 197, the dairy air one, Senate Bill 892, the aerial pesticide spray, and Senate Bill 871, which is the demolitions bills. Okay, we have amendments that are in the works on all of those, and we're not ready to deal with them today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So you're carrying those three over till tomorrow?
I'm carrying them over till tomorrow.
Just wanted that on the record?
Yes. So I'm going to order that and open our work session on Senate Bill 418. And Beth, you want to remind us what this does?
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 418 was heard on April 3rd. It would require the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, at the request of and in coordination with the city, to parse the work task to allow DLCD to issue final orders approving or remanding sequential phases of work related to an urban growth boundary amendment. There is a dash two amendment that specifies that a work task for which DLCD has issued a final order of approval may not be the basis of an objection to a review for final approval of a UGB amendment. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, no subsequent referral.
Yeah. Vice Chair.
Chair Dimmer, I move to adopt the dash two amendment stated 322.17.
Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the dash two amendments dated March 22nd, 2017. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Vice Chair.
Chair Dimmer, I move Senate Bill 418 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 418 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. The motion carries, and Senator Beyer will carry that bill on the floor. I'll close our work session on Senate Bill 418 and open a work session on Senate Bill 557. And colleagues, we are opening this bill in order to send it to Rules.
Senator Dimbro, I move Senate Bill 557 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways of Means be rescinded, and in subsequent referral to Rules be added.
Could we do it without recommendation or not?
It's better to do it with recommendation. Senator Brzozinski has moved Senate Bill 557 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Request that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded and a subsequent referral to Rules be added. Senate Bill 557 is the bill that deals with climate change, and it's what has come to be known as the Clean Energy Jobs Bill. We are sending it to Rules for its next stage. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Robler.
So I have enjoyed the many evening sessions and all of the other kinds of conversations we've had about this bill. I do not believe it's ready. Therefore, I'm happy that we're moving it to a place that we can have a conversation continued, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done for us to have the knowledge and background to implement a bill like this. So I'm willing to move it to rules, but I have out of this committee back to the president's office. But we have to be very careful when we do this and get involved in the right deals, and I appreciate the effort we put into getting information about it. At the same time, from my perspective, we're not quite ready to go there. I'm willing to do this to continue the conversation because I think we need to have a conversation.
Thank you for that statement. And yes, I completely agree with you that this is not a bill that in its current form is ready for the floor.
Okay.
And I wouldn't say it's ready for Ways and Means either.
I agree.
But it is ready for ongoing conversation. And colleagues, once we get past the deadline, we're going to have the luxury of coming back to some of these conversations, meeting jointly with the House. We'll be able to use some of our actual committee time for some of these ongoing conversations. Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, important legislation. A lot of people want it. But as the good Senator Roblin said, that we've done a lot of study in it, and I would make a motion that we move it back to rules without recommendation, because we can't recommend something haven't totally worked on, should I put it that way. So I would make a motion that we move it back without recommendation.
Well, we have a motion on the floor.
His motion comes above mine.
Yeah.
We have
okay.
To vote. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm willing to go there. Is that
okay?
Okay. I'll
thank
defer
you.
To you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bridger.
I would have to, I guess, second Senator Olson's motion. I will be voting to move it back to rules because, yeah, it's definitely not, there's no way I could possibly support it in its form, okay? But I don't want to be misconstrued that I'm moving it to rules because I support it. I'm moving it to rules because I don't support it in its current form.
Okay. Senator Brzezinski, are you willing to send it without a recommendation?
I would prefer sending it with the recommendation, but if the chair wants me to, we've already have a motion there, so I don't need to rescind my motion at this point. I think we just need to take the vote on the current motion that's on top of the one that I've made, and we see where we go from there.
Yeah. If we can all agree on sending it to rules without recommendation, I'm comfortable with that.
Okay.
Okay. Any further discussion, colleagues? Okay.
So I think just for the record, we have a motion that's before us that Senator Olson's put forward that basically says that we are sending it to rules without recommendation. And asking the president to rescind the joint Ways and Means referral and to subsequent referral to rules. Is that
okay.
correct?
Yes.
Okay.
It's good to have an attorney on the panel.
Thank you, Senator
Brzezinski. They always want to know what intent is, right? What's the intent?
Okay, so let me restate, repeat the motion then. Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 557 to the floor without recommendation, requesting that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded and a subsequent referral to rules be added. Any further discussion, colleagues? Okay. Then the motion carries. Okay, I will close our hearing on Senate Bill 557 and open a work session, and I meant to say a work session on 557, and open a work session on Senate Bill 865. And colleagues, this bill is not ready to move. We don't have the paperwork, but we do have amendments that I believe the parties have come to agreement over. So, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Chair Denborough. Chair Denborough, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated 4/12/17.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the -3 amendments dated March 12, 2017. Before we get into discussion, April Snell, can you come up and explain? And is Erin Doyle here?
There she is.
Oh, great.
Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, April Snell, Executive Director with the Oregon Water Resources Congress, thank you for your time today. So, Chair, did you want me to briefly explain what the Dash 3
is? Yeah, just tell us quickly what they do.
So, we've submitted testimony for the record, and I won't repeat all that. Simply in brief, the Dash 3 amendments are based on substantial feedback that we received from folks who testified at the public hearing, as well as additional feedback. And the changes that are important to mention is that we're clarifying that the districts would provide input to the city or the county much earlier in the process than the original bill had it drafted. And so we've put in careful language that clarifies that this would be prior to approving a tentative plan for a proposed plat that is subject to review under ORS 92.044, that is when the city or county would give notice to the district, and that is when they would provide information. The other piece that we put in here is we changed the time frame in which the district would provide that information from 30 days to 15 days. To make it even clear that this is not going to be something that gets in the way of development. We further clarified that the city or county may use this information or they may not use this information as they move forward with the process. And then the other key piece that was added in here is clarifying that in order to receive notice under this section, the districts will provide the cities or counties with a map or other list of information that shows where their boundaries, their rights of way, and easements are to make sure that the cities or counties are properly noticing those folks and giving those folks the opportunity to weigh in on development before it occurs and before it negatively impacts irrigation and other similar entities' infrastructure.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee. Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I just wanted to say thank you to April and to the chair for helping get the Dash 3s together very quickly, and for Beth as well. Their hard work, your all hard work and willingness to work with my folks is very important. There is one thing that I did want to get onto the record just to clarify that this bill is an additional process of notice that goes hand in hand and can be sufficient to meet our requirements for notice on ORS under ORS 92044, but that the locals can do an additional notice process at their leisure, but we are required to follow the notice process that is outlined in this bill. And in addition, I really appreciate the information that we'll be getting. For some of our cities, they're dealing with five or, you know, a couple of irrigation districts, and it's very difficult for us to keep track if there's no maps or list of facilities. So that's a very important piece to make sure that we are working together as partners as we go through these development processes. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess at this time I need to point out that I have a potential conflict of interest since I'm a member and a former board member of Oregon Water Resource Congress.
I didn't know that. Any further, any other questions? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Any discussion of the amendments? Any objection to adopting the amendments? Okay, they are adopted. Vice Chair Olson. Oh, that's right. We don't have the paper. Sorry.
We could have gone on, but.
Yeah, so I'm going to carry Senate Bill 865 over till tomorrow. And I will close our work session on Senate Bill 865. So we will have yet one more bill, one last bill with Senator Roblin's name on it. Were you on this one?
I'm not sure if I was or not.
Yeah, you're either on this
one. Oh, yes, I was.
You're on this
one. I was on this one. Yeah, this is the one I was on.
Great. Okay.
Keep you lined up.
Then let's move up to the top of our agenda, colleagues. I think we covered everything else. And open our public hearing on Senate Bill 1007. And Beth, if you could tell us what this bill does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, Senate Bill 1007 would direct the Department of Energy, in consultation with the Environmental Quality Commission and other interested agencies, to develop a climate test to be used by state permitting agencies for evaluating applications for proposed fossil fuel infrastructure projects in the state. There is a dash one amendment that's posted on OLIS.
Okay, great. Okay, let's start off with Charles Miller, Trish Weber, and Rhett Lawrence, please. Okay, thank you very much. Trish, did you want to lead off, or Rhett, or?
Let's start.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. And on behalf of our more than 20,000 members and supporters in the state of Oregon, I'm pleased to offer our comments on Senate Bill 1007. As an organization with a long history of working on moving beyond fossil fuels in Oregon, the Sierra Club strongly supports Senate Bill 1007. We've been raising the need for a more coordinated and comprehensive view of large fossil fuel projects for a number of years now, and we believe the climate test proposed by this bill is an excellent and necessary tool for Oregon to implement as we begin to deal with the climate changes that are already upon us in the state. And I have submitted written testimony in OLIS, so I won't go through all of it. Just wanted to hit a couple of high points. In essence, this bill would essentially create a state-level and more particularized version of the National Environmental Policy Act, which, you know, our neighbors to the north and south have what they call SEPAs, State Environmental Policy Act. We've tried for a few sessions to get a SEPA passed in Oregon, and weren't able to do that. But this bill would create a mechanism by which, for large fossil fuel infrastructure projects, all the state agencies that are tasked with granting permits or considering permits for that project would be able to work together, work in a comprehensive fashion, look at the project as a whole, consider the permits across agencies, importantly. It would also put in place a system by which climate impacts on the state of Oregon would have to be considered. In addition to creating the system by which all the permits are considered as a whole, this is one big project that the climate test would be put in place, which also has an economic component, which Trish Weber will describe in more detail momentarily. In essence, you know, we just believe that this is a good mechanism by which these large fossil fuel infrastructure projects could be considered, climate impacts considered as part of the analysis, and we believe that the climate test put forward in Senate Bill 1007 is a necessary tool for the state of Oregon, and we certainly support it and encourage this committee to do the same. So now I'll turn it over to the real expert, Trish Weber.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. My name is Patricia Weber, and I live in Corvallis. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony in support of SB 1007 with the Dash 1 Amendment, the climate test bill. I'd like to begin my testimony by borrowing something that a good friend of mine likes to say, giving credit to Eric DePlace of Sightline Institute. That is, there are essentially two ways to bring about the zombie apocalypse. And the first is to continue using fossil fuels exactly the way we do now without changing. And the second way is to stop using all fossil fuels tomorrow. Not being a fan of the zombie apocalypse, our challenge over the next several decades is to figure out a way to ramp down our fossil fuels at a pace that threads that needle and limits global warming to less than catastrophic levels, while at the same time not crashing the global economy. To that end, in December of 2015, 195 countries convened in Paris and signed what has become known as the Paris Climate Accord, in which the signatories pledged to limit climate change to well below 2 degrees C by the year 2100. The pledge means, this pledge means that jurisdictions all over the world will take the steps needed to decarbonize the global economy at a practical pace, which will drastically alter the demand and thus the price of fossil fuels. Here in Oregon, we need to base our fossil fuel infrastructure policy on what we expect the global energy economy will be based on the climate accord, not what the fossil fuel industry would like business as usual to continue as. Oregon, as a state, has relatively low GHG emissions, especially compared to larger economies like our neighbor to the south. However, our geographic location between the large fossil fuel reserves in the interior of the continent and potential markets in Asia means that our deep water ports are highly desirable for the shipment of fossil fuels across the world. The evidence of this is manifested in the numerous large-scale fossil fuel infrastructure projects, such as pipelines and export terminals, that have been proposed over the last several years. We are a vital link in a global supply network, and as such, should make our fossil fuel infrastructure policy decisions in the context of global energy markets. The climate test is a powerful, inexpensive, and efficient tool for evaluating whether a large-scale fossil fuel infrastructure project would be a good fit for Oregon. The key element of the climate test is the requirement for an economic viability analysis under what's called a well below 2 degrees C scenario. This will determine whether the risks to our air, water, wildlife, and climate posed by fossil fuel megaprojects are justified by the promise of jobs that accompany them. If we have reason to believe that the price of fossil fuels will drop to the point where a given infrastructure project will not be profitable and will instead go out of business in relatively short order, we should not be investing our valuable deep water ports on it. The climate test will provide us the information we need to make that determination. Oregon should say no to stranded assets and yes to a sustainable economy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Trish. Mr. Miller.
My name is Charles Miller. I'm a retired professor of oceanography at Oregon State. I've done a great deal of teaching about climate change to graduate students and others. The climate test bill as drafted assigns the Oregon Department of Energy a very difficult task. They are to weigh the job creation, other social goods and economic benefits, including personal and private and business profits, to be generated by, quote, new or expanded large-scale infrastructure, close quote, for the use of fossil fuel. Compare that against the climate impact costs of the project. ODOE would be empowered to approve or deny permits based on the comparison. The benefits of any given project can be vaguely quantified, but the costs to everyone worldwide of adding more greenhouse gas to the atmosphere are not measurable. The chemical and physical properties of the atmosphere are literally invaluable. That is, they are beyond assigning the value of jobs, dollars, lives lost, or lives protected. It is not just human lives. Onrushing climate disruption and shifting ocean chemistry threaten the invaluable health of the entire global ecosystem that supports us and all life. I have no idea how ODOE could make such a comparison beyond deciding to allow no new fossil fuel infrastructure. Nothing beyond replacing presently unsafe facilities. From a climate protection point of view, that is exactly the policy Oregon and the United States needs. Therefore, I heartily endorse this bill. Reserve to Oregon the power to say no to emitting climate damage from Oregon, damage which will last for millennia. The present ascension of climate change denial at the federal level makes reserving that power the most important thing the Oregon legislature can do in 2017. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. Questions, colleagues? Let me ask a question. I'm looking at the Dash 1 amendments.
Which I have not seen. Huh?
Okay. It goes into a series of answers to what is the purpose of the climate test. And, you know, one of the things that it says is in subsection A on page 2, provide for a comprehensive review of the immediate and anticipated long-term environmental impacts of a proposed fossil fuel infrastructure project that determines the economic viability of a project when evaluated against the investments required across the energy sector to have at least a 66% probability of limiting climate change to a global mean temperature increase of 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. So, Trish, the 2 degree, that's the target from the Paris Accord,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's correct. And within this, the 66% probability of limiting climate change to a global mean temperature increase of 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100, it's really a mouthful. And the reason for that is this directly references several documents that have been produced within the last few months that are essentially roadmaps on how to transition to this point. One of them was by the International Energy Agency, and I submitted that as testimony. I'm not expecting anybody to read it. I haven't read it. But just to make it very clear that there is technical information that has already been developed in the world and exists that the Department of Energy can use to mm-hmm. to verify the economic viability right. of a given project based on its financials.
What again, is the baseline for 2 degrees?
I think the questions
the
come
NOAA,
from these guys.
The NOAA values or the
Charles, why don't you direct your question to me?
But she knows the answer.
But that's not the way it
yeah.
works.
Yes.
The change
yes,
since 1880 is almost 2 degrees now, 1.9 degrees centigrade in the global temperature anomaly. It's now 1 degree since the 1950 to 1980 period of fairly stable global temperature averages. In 2015, a full 0.2 degree centigrade jump happened. There have been other jumps that size in the record, and it's possible it will go down slightly in 2017. So the 2016 level was 0.2. It went off the NOAA and NASA graph scale. Right. It was that big.
So, Dr. Miller, your point is that the 2% is inadequate? Is that?
That the situation is so serious that the thing we need to do is add no new fossil fuel infrastructure worldwide, including Oregon. Everybody has to be in.
Okay, thank you. And Trish, again, to understand sort of the rationale here, the concern, I mean, one of the concerns, certainly there's the environmental concern, but from the economic concern, it's that countries that have committed to abiding by the Paris Accords are not going to be able to do so if they use the exported product, and then there may be commitments that are expected that aren't going to be able to be met. It is for markets. Is that what
well,
we're saying?
So really, what ends up happening with the what's called the well below 2 degrees scenario is that. When all the churning and math of the 300-page document, for example, from the IEA is said and done, the conclusion that's reached is that in order to meet the 2-degree target agreed to by the Paris signatories, actions will be taken that will result in a price at which fossil fuels will be able to be sold. Okay, and for example, for oil, it'll be $50 to $60 a barrel. And that's, if we're going to meet our climate goal of 2%, it's going to end up at $50 to $60 a barrel. So when you look at a project like, for example, a tar sands pipeline, tar sands expansion requires that prices be around $90, $80 to $90 a barrel. And that's just the numbers because it's so expensive to get that stuff out of the ground that if they can't sell it for $80 to $90, then they can't afford. And with prices right now being at about $50, $60, we're seeing tar sands projects being canceled right and left. And two of the world's global energy suppliers have completely pulled out of the tar sands. So that is how it really works, is we just say, okay, you want to build a project. What does the, you know, how much is it going to cost for you to be able to be profitable? Do you need, if it's an oil terminal, can you make money if the price of oil, you know, is $50 a barrel, or do you need it to be $40 a barrel, or do you need it to be $80 a barrel? And if your numbers come in and say, well, we can only make money if it's $80 a barrel, then it makes sense for us to say, well, no, don't build this, because the market is not going to give you that money eventually. I mean, there may be some wiggling around in the next year or two, but we're going to end up with a stranded asset. And when that happens, we're going to have this big oil export terminal on a piece of very valuable land that we'd have to demolish, we'd have to decommission, we'd have to do remediation on toxic waste, and it's a big, you know, it's a bad investment.
Okay, thank
I have
you.
One question.
Yeah, go ahead.
In the Paris Accord, the United States said they would go from about 6 billion metric tons back to 4 billion metric tons, but China is allowed to increase by 4 billion metric tons from their current output. How do you extrapolate that to really help America when we're going backwards and China is increasing?
Well, the way I look at that is honestly not saying, well, what's one country doing individually versus another country individually? It's what is going to be the aggregate result of all the actions taken in sum total. And where are the energy prices going to be at that point? Because, you know, there could be some variation, you know, within, without. I mean, the United States could pull completely out of the Paris Accord, but if other countries move forward, and we end up with the energy prices being such that Bakken oil or Powder River Basin coal is not something that the world wants to buy from us, investing in infrastructure that allows us to export it is going to be just building something that goes out of business.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, all three of you. We'll bring up our next panel. And members of the audience, you'll see members coming and going during the hearing. It has nothing to do with anything you're saying. You're not driving them away, I promise. They have to testify on their bills that are in other committees.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's have Tracy Farwell and Ed Averill come up, please. Welcome, gentlemen. Ed, Tracy, whoever wants to start.
Shall I go? Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, and remaining members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tracy Farwell. I'm representing a small Oregon climate research effort. We regard the merit of SB 1007 climate testing is that it forecloses on more carbon risk. Unfortunately, we don't believe it can be effective citing 2100 as a decision reference date as taken from the IEA, as Ms. Weber reported. In the same paragraph we've been discussing, section 2, subparagraph 2A. We think it's 50 years late. If you're typically, physicists look at life a little bit different than engineers do. I do the engineering thing. You can lose control of carbon in the environment by 2050, and you will never get it back by 2100. So please consider in your deliberations that we should be moving that forward by 50 years, which lines up with other publicly stated zero carbon objectives. As we describe in our testimony on file for this hearing, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be heard today, the impact of climate change, according to the Brookings Institute citation in our paper, is a 20% hit on global GDP by the year 2100. On top of that, the Guardian News Service reports that if left unchecked, continued climate change causes current global financial assets to be overvalued by $2.5 trillion. Damage to the U.S. economy, according to an NRDC study, will grow to $1.9 trillion by the year 2100. A study reported by a West Coast Economic Research Group based in California, which gave testimony before your committee earlier this month, predicts at least $2 billion loss against Oregon's GDP. We know that members of the Senate and House Environment Committees have asked those giving testimony previously to explain what benefit to Oregon any cuts in our CO2 will have regarding in terms of reducing U.S. CO2 and globally, and no answers have been given. And we offer these answers in our testimony on file with the appropriate references. The numbers tell us that when we try to understand what control we have over Oregon's climate future, there's virtually no leverage in our failure, and this is because our total contribution to global CO2 emission is 0.1%. That's an interesting number. It means that there's a ratio of 1,000 to 1 that's working against us. Climate impacts seem to be leveraged seriously against our efforts. Oregon's vulnerability to climate damage after others reap carbon profits could be a bitter pill. Our antidote with this bill is to manage our own carbon inventory, and in doing so demonstrate a rare instance of both mercy and hope with a chance to limit future climate damage. And thank you for taking testimony on this important matter.
Thanks a lot, Tracy.
Hi, I'm Ed Averill. I'm a former engineer, retired, living in Beaverton. In recent hours, it was announced that the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has rejected the National Fuel's plans to create the Northern Access Pipeline, a 97-mile pipeline to carry natural gas from Pennsylvania across New York. They did it on mostly local environmental grounds, as we have won most of the battles in the Northwest. And it is often the case that a damaging project has enough local damage that you can make such a case. But I think we need to do better than that. And I thank you guys for facilitating this bill coming to be available to help with that. Oregon needs to strengthen their position and this bill. And this bill would give us good decisions on projects that could be shown to be damaging projects. In the face of permafrost that's beginning to bubble across the Arctic in Canada and Siberia, we need to get busy turning down the climate heat. We don't know when the end's coming, but that is one of the really scary situations that you might think about learning about. In saving the planet from climate change, it takes a global effort. Everybody needs to do their part. As Tracy said, we're very leveraged such that our commitment wouldn't be that big a difference one way or the other. But you could take every little place in the world and say that of it. And you would fail if you let people take their greed and use it to work against the common good. So this climate test bill can prevent big abusive projects from happening. As we try it out, we'll probably find out it's not quite right and come back and tweak it. I don't care. Good. 4/5 of the current declared reserves by fossil fuel companies, 4/5 of them cannot be burned and have us achieve that 2-degree target. That means also that all of the carbon that we can burn exists in open mines, pipelines, and open wells. You don't need to create a new one to have enough carbon to destroy the planet. So I very much, adamantly, support this bill. I hope it does the good it needs to do. This gives us the opportunity to go from a position where we were wishing we could control what we were doing and do it right, to being able to control it and do it right. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Okay, thank you both very much. Lucinda Heitz-Claybaugh and Thomas Mosher, please. Okay, why don't you get started, Lucinda?
Okay, my name is Lucinda Heitz-Claybaugh, and I've worked for over 30 years as a science
Lucinda,
and math.
Lucinda, you don't have to be up against. You can sit back.
Okay. I've been a science and math educator for over 30 years, and I am here to talk about real science and real math. And I do agree with Dr. Charles Miller that if you look at the actual math and you look at the actual science, and this is what the United Nations Emissions Gap Report, November 2014, came up with when they actually measured with satellites. They measured what is in our atmosphere. What is it constituted from? We've got a certain amount of methane, we've got a certain amount of carbon dioxide, and we actually measured it. And a lot of our theoretical ideas mathematically were wrong. The bottom line is we blew it. We made a mistake. We didn't count on methane being as much of a problem as it actually ends up being. It doesn't leave the atmosphere as quickly as we thought. It doesn't break down. We have the temperatures going up for years and years, and we hadn't counted on some of that. And then that domino effect, we hadn't counted on that either. So some of the math was wrong, and the scientists have now had to go and hurry really fast to see what we really do need to do. We cannot continue business as usual, and while Trish made some points from an economic perspective, scientifically, the data is actually telling us we don't have that much time. The actual data says that we don't have what we thought was this trajectory going straight at this angle, but now we're actually, when you add the methane, you see the blue? Do you see how much quicker it has an uptick now? And that is, if you look, 2025. We're talking 8 to 10 years. The next three will be very critical, according to the Kyoto Protocol work. And again, this is IPCC, Global Carbon Project. This is actual data, our newest stuff that we have. Unfortunately, because we hadn't counted in all the methane, now we have to go faster than we thought. And I'm sorry that we can't let people continue to pollute as long as they'd like and make money off it, but there are some common concerns that they have to take precedence. You, sirs, have children, grandchildren, and you want to have great-grandchildren, hopefully, to see a future. I have a son, and I'd like to see him have children in a future, too. And there is one way we can do that. I'm not doom and gloom because we have the technology to stop this. We can't wait till 2100. We have to start now. Within these next 3 years, we have to make some critical decisions for transitioning. We're not saying today. We're saying we'll give you 3 years. But at that point, the Kyoto Protocol said, and I'll quote this directly from that research, the mitigation needs to ramp up much higher from 2020 to 2030, or we will have a hard time surviving, period, because it will stay in the atmosphere longer than we'd anticipated. So we can do something about it. We can switch to solar. We can switch to our wind generators. We can switch to wind and wave, tidal. We have electric car batteries. We have a lot of technology right now Why haven't we had the world leadership to tell us this? Well, Denmark has been telling us. Germany has also been telling us. Europe and other leaders in the world have been making some of these changes. They said, we're going to be 100% renewable today for a whole day. Everybody in the whole country. It's an effort from the whole country, and they did it. Okay, now let's do it for a week. And they did it. Let's do it for a month. They are showing us models of how we can do this. We have the technology. It is not hopeless. But we are in the lifeboat because the Titanic started to sink back when it hit 350 parts per billion. And we're already way past that. We're about 412, 420. So these charts I would like to put into the record because they are the proof mathematically that if we go 1.5C, we've got 2025. 8 years. Then 2037, if we only take the 2 degree, then we're going to have to push even harder to survive that last little bit after 2037. So goals are good, but Oregon didn't even meet our first ones from 2010 that we said we'd really meet. These others are just not realistic to what we have to deal with. It doesn't mean we're going to destroy our economies. We're going to change and transition a new paradigm, shifting our economies. But a lot of Oregon is on board.
Linda, could you wrap up, please?
Yeah.
In closing, could you connect it to the climate test?
Well, I would love to see this bill go through. I would like to see some tweaks in the timeline. 2100 is not an adequate timeline. It needs to be many years, like 2030 is what realistically, according to math and science, and people are telling us we need to do now. So we can do this, but we have to make some leadership changes in how we think about how we will survive this. We're not going to get leadership from Trump. We know that. We need it from you. Your children will demand this of you. Today is Youth Day. There are a lot of children out there, and I hope that some of them will come and testify before you, and that you think of them in the decision-making you make, because it is their futures.
Okay.
Or not.
Thank you very much. Listen, any questions?
Yes, I'll answer any questions you have, and I would like this to go into the record, all three of these charts.
You could just give it to Shelley. Thank you.
And explain any further science or math you need on any of that.
Okay, that ends our testimony on Senate Bill 1007. So I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 1007. And, okay, I said I was going to go in order, but I'm actually going to go out of order because I want to, we only have a few people who've signed up for 1048. We have a lot who signed up for 1037. So I'd like to get Senate Bill 1048 out of the way. Not that I don't respect it at all, please. So I'm going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 1048. And Courtney, were you going to? Yeah. Courtney, Alex Kyler, and John Chandler, want to come up?
Chairman Denbrough and members of the committee, my name is Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's intergovernmental relations.
Actually, could you hold off for a minute, Alex? Beth,
yeah.
I should have asked you to read the bill. Could you tell us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1048 would prevent a city or county to adjust a property line through a progression of property line adjustments that incorporate further adjustments of adjusted properties.
Okay, that's crystal clear. Thank you.
That was just the adjustment.
All
adjustment.
Right. Okay, Alex.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1048 is a bill that Lane County supports. We appreciate the sponsor for bringing this forward. The issue stems from an appeal of a county decision in Lane County whereby LUBA determined that every single property line adjustment must be made as a unique and discrete action by the county. Previously, we had been using a process where we would do multiple property lot line adjustments as one action. And so you can imagine that when this appeal came back with that finding by LUBA, the implication is that when a customer comes to the county for a lot line adjustment, they'll have to pay an individual application for that, as well as recording the deed for each individual action after the fact. And what this bill does is to allow for the county to do multiple property lot line adjustments as in a serial manner and consider that as one action. Thereby, we're going to make the process much easier and convenient, as well as cheaper for the customers that come before us. So we do support the measure. I think the appeal from LUBA did send some ripples around the state in terms of planners sort of being surprised at this finding. My understanding is there are a number of counties that were doing things this way, and they were rather alarmed at the decision. And I think you'll hear some of that testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here to help you through the land use weeds on this bill to the extent I can. And this is probably the second or third bill this session. I don't recall if we've had one in this committee before where a practice that was previously very common, legal as far as anybody knew, you get a LUBA case, you get a court of appeals case, you can't do it that way, and this is, so everybody gets their fruit basket upset. That's really what this is. Prior to the Bowerman case, which is the one that Mr. Kaler referred to, sequential property line adjustments in the same application were very common. What a property line adjustment is, as defined in the statute, is when you have a parcel of land with four lots, let's say, and they each have their own property line, you can have a procedure where you go in and you move the lines around. You can't create a new lot. You can't go from four lots to five lots. You can move the lines around of those four lots. That's what we would do from a developer standpoint, a property owner standpoint, is come in and say, I'm going to move these lines around on this whole parcel with those same four lots, do it in one application, one time, same set of appeals. It doesn't take away anybody's rights to do it sequentially as it than it does doing them individually. Under the Bowerman case, you have to now go in and do lot line adjustment one, wait your appeal period, pay your fee, do your survey, then come back in and do lot line adjustment number two, and so on down the line. And as it was mentioned, it just gets very expensive, very time-consuming. And like I said, it doesn't take away, this bill would not take away or add to the existing rights of any citizen to challenge that process. It would just simply mean that the person going through the process could go through it much more expeditiously. And most of the time, these things happen without any objection. They're pretty routine and pretty commonplace. We think it's a good bill. We commend it to you. Hope your vote do pass when the time comes, and be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Courtney Johnston, for the record, representing Deschutes County today. I don't want to reiterate what my colleagues here said, but just to add to what he said here, that this process creates both financial and planning burdens for applicants and excessive administrative obligations for public agencies while doing nothing to change the final outcomes of property line adjustment decisions other than to add the costs and to add delays. So we brought this bill forward because we think it's important to help create a more streamlined system that we had previously before this LUBA decision. And I just want to put on the record that this does not roll back Oregon's important land use protections. This bill does not allow property owners to manipulate the buildable land standards, and I just want to make that clear. But I think they covered everything, so thank you for allowing us to have a hearing today.
Great. Vice Chair Olson.
First off, I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest because I do property line adjustments, and this could possibly affect me. And I will say that the last one I did took 7 months, so and was very expensive. I would just concur with your statements.
I have a question. I don't know if any of you know. What was the rationale behind the LUBA decision? Why did they upset the apple cart from your perspective?
My goodness, Mr. Chair, look at the time. It would probably be somewhat unkind to call it a drive-by, but it wasn't far from it. The base case in Bowerman was not about the lot line adjustments, but that Luba noticed, and I think it was obviously pled by one of the appellants in the case, that they were fault that the sequential was not supported by the statute. And I don't read the statute that way, and people up for many years prior to this hadn't read the statute that way, but Luba did. The underlying issue had more to do with the use being made of the land, if I read the case correctly, not the, how the land was being divvied up.
And when the land is being divvied up, who is divvying it up? I mean, Senator Olson, you said that you...
You're not being divvying it up. What you're doing is you're just making, in my particular case, I had four lots, and they needed to be 60-foot frontage. But when they laid out the entire subdivision, you could only get 59 feet 6 inches on the last lot, which didn't meet the requirements. So by moving lot lines just a couple inches, I reduced the necessity for the 60-foot because I still had the 7,000-square-foot minimum, but I got the other one very close to 60 feet. So just by moving those lot lines, each one of those was a very expensive process. Just we call it a lot line adjustment. Mm. And should be pretty simple, but... wasn't.
Okay. Any other questions, Kelly?
Mr. Chair, I think I think I have one, but I want to pull up the bill because I want to see if testimony came in or not from it. I received I received an email from Bowerman that was involved in this case, and so I was wondering if he actually filed anything yet because I told him that I think it is there. So I think I just want to see if it's what I received. So, Mr. Chair, I'll just call to your attention, there is a testimony from Mackenzie Bowerman, who was the petitioner, I guess, in this case, on the case. And the short note that I got was somewhat interesting. I don't want to say contradictory, but it does seem like it was a little different from what we're hearing, because what he says in the email is basically that this was a 9 property line adjustment between 8 subject properties that was not subject to public notices or a local right of appeal, and the effect was to allow 3 template dwellings approvals in an F2 forest zone where they wouldn't have been permissible before. So it does seem like, in that case, at least from what Bowerman has said, you actually were able to create new dwelling sites that would not have been allowed. And it goes on, it says, Luba ruled that the adjustments were unlawful under the current statute because there was further adjustments of the adjusted properties in a single land use decision.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brzezinski, the way I understand this case was that lot line adjustments were not considered land use decisions by the county, that lot line adjustments are more process oriented. The decision about a forest template dwelling has an appeal right based on the criteria, so that there is a separate process for appealing that development of a forest template plot, if you will, and that's one of the contemplations of this bill, is that the county argues that the lot line adjustments are simply a process. The appeal process for a finding of a certain kind of lot is maintained. That has not changed. The process of adjusting lot lines ought to be allowed more than one at a time. And that's what the bill would establish, is that you could do multiple plot lines. And as Mr. Chandler said, we've been doing those. We've done those. We have hundreds of those that we've done. And the concern over the finding out of Luba was that this potentially puts hundreds of those previous decisions at jeopardy.
And I would just add that, according to my planning folks, Mr. Chair and Senator Brzezinski, prior to a new configuration, you need to demonstrate that the lot alignment meets the forest template standards or the whatever template standards you're working under, and that you still have to prove that this was this new configuration, that it was buildable land already. That's the way they've interpreted it, and that's the way that they operate.
Mr. Chair, follow
yes, follow up.
I have not looked at the complete bill, but Alex, does the bill have a retroactive provision in it?
Senator Dembro and Senator Przanski, it does.
If I might, Mr. Chair, too, and I flippantly referred to it as a drive-by, and I wasn't trying to make fun of Luba's opinion, and I'm certainly not opining on the merits of the decision in the Bowerman case. I don't know enough about it. I think where Luba landed on the forest template dwelling issue may well have been accurate. But I was reading the opinion right now, or their case, where they discuss several different statutory changes to the lot line adjustment statute. And if I'm reading it right, where Luba high centered was on the notion that the statute says it has to be you're moving the lines of a legally established lot, but there's an extensive and fairly boring, frankly, discussion of the case law and the statutory law, that because if you do these sequentially, there is no established lot off of which to move the property line, make the adjustment from, so you have to do them one at a time. That's where Luba came down. That's what we think is the change from previous practice, not to get into the issue of whether or not these are template dwellings or appropriately the underlying land use issue was properly decided. That's what I mean by it was sort of as long as we're in the neighborhood talking about this process, I think they went back over the top of existing practice in a way that doesn't change the outcome on the forest template issue, in other words.
One other question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Did Lane County appeal? So is the appeal pending? If they appealed, is the appeal still pending?
Senator Dembro and Senator Przanski, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that, our board changed processes several years ago where appellants could bypass the Board of County Commissioners and go straight to Luba, and that was the case in this case. They did not go to the board for a finding first, and whether that has implications for the appeal or not, I'm not certain. I will follow up with you on that.
Mr. Chair, if I could. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, it'd be very important to know if we still have a judicial proceeding that's pending or ongoing in this particular case that we're now asked to rewrite the law.
Right. That's a fair question. And, as I mentioned before, we're not working this bill today. We have a lot of testimony that's been submitted and things that I think we're going to need to review. But thank you very much, all three of you. Our last panel, actually, we have a proponent and an opponent. I'm going to bring you up together and beg you to behave. Kim O'Day and Sid Friedman, please. And I know you will.
Yeah. We can have a chair in between them.
Okay. There's a chair between
the
two.
Yeah, that's right.
Wise choice.
Yes, Kim, you want to start?
Kim O'Day, Law Office of Bill Close. We're the intervener respondents on the Iggy case, so I think I can probably answer most of those questions. And we do have Court of Appeals pending, and it was argued last week. Okay. So that's where we're at with that. Everything was said so nicely, I kind of hate to take up your time, so I'm going to go quickly through this, and then I'll get back to the quick template question and how that kind of falls into this. I think the most important part of this is to understand that it doesn't add any. I was looked at some of the testimony that's already been submitted, and this doesn't add any new rules, and it doesn't take away any rules. This is just what we would call a clarification of how you read the existing statute. And if we don't get this clarification, as you've heard, the need to take multiple property line adjustments are necessary, and they're not just necessary for development. If you have 20 acres and you want to add 15 acres because you need more acreage for your cattle from your neighbors, but you need 5 acres from each of your neighbors. By the definition of property line adjustment, you can only move one of those lines at a time. And so you've got to move 1-5 and then 1-5 and then 1-5 to get your additional 15. If we were to have to take each and every one of those to the county and then go through a separate process and then wait the appeal period, we could be up a year and a half just to gain another 15 acres that have no development rights to them. So these, what we call series property line adjustments, have a lot of uses, and that's just because of the definition of property line adjustment needing to move a single line. And here, what LUBA did, and this was the all the template stuff aside, what LUBA did was insert a word that doesn't exist. They inserted the word existing, which the legislature took out several years ago. And so we are going back to get some clarity that you don't have to have that existing piece before you move on to the next. And it's very efficient for everybody. And again, it does not take away your ability to appeal these things. All it does is put them in a series that makes a lot of sense, because if they're one after the another, same planner gets to review them. They get to do it once and not have to come back to different planners each and every time. You record them sequentially, so if you're looking for them, they're easy to find because they're generally one after the other. It's better for applicants because they're just putting everything together, and if there's something wrong, you correct it now in the series instead of having to, let's say something wrong's with the middle or they catch the middle one, and then you got to go back and maybe fix the first one after it's recorded. That's also very problematic. So we're just trying to clean up a very small piece of what happened in that Bowerman case. The last thing I'll say about the bill in general is it doesn't change the outcome at all, what we're proposing. LUBA said in Bowerman itself, you can do series property line adjustments. Absolutely. We just want you to do them differently. So it doesn't change the outcome. We can get there either way. And this just makes it cleaner for everybody to do. And so I guess I will open it back up to the questions that were previous that maybe I can answer that they could not.
Okay, well, let's hear from Sid, and then we'll have questions. Yes, welcome.
Chair Dembrough, committee members, Sid Friedman for Friends of Yamhill County. Our organization is affiliated with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and I'm testifying on behalf of both organizations in opposition to SB 1048. The bill is not simply a housekeeping measure that reestablishes what was common practice or existing law previous to a LUBA decision. It instead makes substantive changes in the process that will allow the manipulation of parcel boundaries and locations in manners that go way beyond the more simple descriptions that my friend here described and my friend John Chandler described. It in fact would allow the shifting of a parcel location so that the actual parcel could wind up a quarter of a mile or more from its original location. And in the case of Lane County, this was in order to qualify parcels for residential dwellings that would not have otherwise qualified. The bill would allow the actual relocation and not just a simple property line adjustment. It would allow the actual relocation of a parcel. And as you heard, it would also retroactively legitimize what were some particularly egregious property line adjustments in Lane County that were done with the intention of qualifying multiple parcels for forest template dwellings. If LUBA did in fact get it wrong by inserting the word existing or taking out the word existing where it didn't appear in statute, I'm confident the Court of Appeals will get it right, and there won't be any need for a legislative fix because that's a matter for the courts. But it's important to remember that farm and forest zones are industrial zones that are intended to protect two of our economy's leading industries, farming and forestry. And the real intent of this bill, or the real effect of this bill, whatever its intent, would be to allow the manipulation of parcel locations to not only qualify dwellings, parcels for dwellings and forest template dwellings, but also to manipulate parcel locations and boundaries in order to qualify for uses in EFU zones where soil quality may be a criterion, or there may be other criteria at play, locational criteria at play. It's a little ironic that we're having this discussion after hearing about climate change and greenhouse gases, because I don't think there's any doubt that scattered rural development contributes to the transportation portion of our greenhouse carbon emissions. And keeping existing law is really a low-cost way of not making the situation worse. I'd like to just add one other point. The process that Lane County uses is not common. It's certainly not one that we use in Yamhill County. We don't process land use, lot line adjustments as a ministerial decision. We don't process lot line adjustments in a series we would allow what the situation that Senator Olson described, whereby you adjust a common boundary between two abutting parcels as they exist. We wouldn't allow a series of property line adjustments between multiple parcels so that the location of parcel one shifts, jumps over parcel two, three, four, and five, so all of a sudden it's over here, four or five parcels removed. And that's the situation that was occurring in Lane County, as I understand it. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Ms. O'Day, would you like to respond to that?
Well, just 2 points in that LUBA and the Court of Appeals have come back numerous times to say serial property line adjustments are okay. That is well settled. You can take a lot from over here as long as you do it line by line by line and put it over here. Now, whether you can qualify it for a template or some other type of development, that's a different issue. But that issue is already well settled out there, that you can't deny someone's ability. It's not the skipping portion. You can't do that. But you can take that line, move it with this neighbor, to move it to this neighbor, and move it one at a time all the way across. This bill is simply about being able to do that with one eye shot, one set of eyes, seeing how you've done it to see if you've done it correctly. So it's not a change, because right now you can go do serious property line adjustments and you would not be able to appeal them if they were done correctly, because it's already been settled. There's nothing wrong with serious property line adjustments. It's the outcome of them that is a bigger discussion that I think my friend here wants to talk about. So just in response to that, I don't think I have anything else.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you. This bill came to us very late, and I'm going to have to do a little research on it. So
thank you
for your help. Okay, with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 1048 and open our last public hearing. This is on Senate Bill 1037. Beth, could you tell us what this is?
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 1037 would allow a local government to enact or enforce local law to prohibit the production or use of seeds or seed products for purposes of protecting non-genetically engineered seeds or products from adverse impacts of genetically engineered seeds or seed products.
Okay. So we don't have an actual carrier of this, do we?
No, not here today.
All right, then I'm gonna call up people. We have a lot of people who've signed up. I doubt that we'll have time to get through everyone, but I certainly want to bring up those of you who have traveled a long distance to come here. And so I'll have alternating panels of for and against the bill, and starting with those who have indicated that they live more than 100 miles away. So let's start with Mary Middleton, Don Tipping, and Carol Valentine, please. Welcome. Thank you for coming all this way. We're going to try to get through as many people as possible, so we're going to put the two-minute clock on. If you could keep your testimony short. If you have submitted testimony, you don't need to read it. It's on the record. You can just talk in your own words. Okay. So go in whatever order you want to go in.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dembrough and committee, for hearing us today. My name is Mary Middleton, and I'm the director of Oregonians for Safe Farms and Families. That's a nonprofit in Josephine County. And I'm here today as the director of OSFF, representing the more than 16,000 citizens in Josephine County who resoundingly voted to ban GE crops in our county. I'm here representing those citizens who come from all walks of life, In that campaign, I was the campaign manager, and citizens came together, farmers, more than 50 farms, hundreds of farmers, more than 150 local businesses, across party lines. Our county is a largely Republican county, but we have liberal, conservative, progressive, all of them came together for the issue to protect our farmers. So the issue of whether or not we want to ban the growth of GE crops in Josephine County is very clear. So I'm asking you today to support SB 1037 and to honor the will of the people. I'm here also making a final point that we're asking for flexibility in Oregon, and we're asking for a vote for rural Oregon. We need the flexibility in Oregon to make our own agricultural decisions. It's a very diverse state, as you all know. And we need the flexibility to utilize the legislative process set forth by our forefathers. We've done that in Josephine County, and so we ask for you to honor the will of the people and a vote for rural Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
All right. Good afternoon. Thanks for your time today. My name is Don Tipping. I am a certified organic farmer, and I also am a business owner. I have a seed company that sells certified organic seed throughout Oregon and nationwide. We produce about 7 acres of seed at our home farm, and I manage a number of lease fields, and we also contract with about 24 other certified organic growers who produce vegetable, flower, and herb seeds. Being certified organic, our customers and our clients are expecting that seed that they get from us is free of GMO contamination. There's about 36 varieties that we produce of corn, beets, chard, and mustards that are at risk of cross-contamination from GE crops. So for us, this is an economic issue, our business model, our reputation, and also the good faith that our clients put in us and our business, and the network of growers that we work with is not compatible with the coexistence model that's being put forth by the USDA and the ODA. So I'm here really to urge you to support small-scale family farms and this measure 1037 to advocate the kind of agriculture like what we do and the network of growers we work with. And having been there for over two decades now, I'm seeing that all of the vegetable and food crop-based agriculture that's moving into Southern Oregon is all certified organic. So this is an emerging economic market. The organic food sector last year was $40 billion. It's the fastest-growing element of the food system, growing at 20% a year. So we really would appreciate some support down where we're at. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Carol Valentine, and I'm speaking in support of SB 1037. I live in Selma at the southern end of Josephine County in a very rural valley, and I am a constituent of Senator Bert Sugars. I believe that all local jurisdictions should be able to consider their own agricultural needs, but I would ask this committee to, in the least, respect the ordinance that was passed by the voters of my county. Our measure was supported across a political spectrum, as Mary said, and we allowed farmers a full year to phase out any GE crops that they were growing. If other farming communities in our state chose not to restrict GMOs, this bill does not affect them. Josephine County residents are generally strong on property rights, and they chose to put in place common sense protections for our farmers because they understand that pollen does not respect their property lines. They became very concerned in the Illinois Valley when they found out that a biotech company from Switzerland was using our area for a testing ground for GE sugar beets when they couldn't even grow their products in their own country. They These were grown in undisclosed locations, and those turned out to be, in some cases, very close to farms that were not that were growing non-GE crops. And we have a very long, narrow valley where pollen can travel long distances on wind. Our farms remain at risk of contamination because the state has not put any protections in place. And we also in the Illinois Valley have hundreds, if not thousands, of gardeners. Many of us save seeds as well.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just
yes,
quick
Senator.
Question. Just curious, you know, as I rumble through all the material that we get to rumble through. Coexistence, you said that, could you elaborate a little bit on coexistence and what are the challenges with coexistence?
Sure. You know, and perhaps I'll use an anecdotal story of my own personal experience. Okay. So we were working with Fry Family Farm, that is one of the larger vegetable producers in our area. They grow about 100 acres of organic vegetables. And we were doing some seed production with them outside of Medford, Jacksonville area. And we had, you know, a good amount of Swiss chard for growing for seed, and that would cross with GMO sugar beets. And this was back before the GMO sugar beets were deregulated by the USDA. We found out they were being grown as a research project at the OSU Extension there, the Southern Oregon Research Center. So I, you know, talked with a farmer, and we were looking at it. We're like, okay, this is a biennial. It takes 2 years. Are we going to, like, you know, water it, weed it, you know, do all that work to grow for about 18 months to find out that most likely it was contaminated because a half mile away they're GMO sugar beets. And we're just looking at it. We're farmers. We've got a lot of – I grow 450 different seed crops. So we chose to just mow it under. Now I kind of kick myself because I would have really liked to have that, you know, the smoking gun, so to speak, to show that coexistence doesn't work. But in research, because I submitted testimony when the Center for Food Safety sued the USDA over the deregulation of GMO sugar beets. I was an expert witness in that case in 2008 and 2009. And from that, we found out that, you know, sugar beet pollen being wind pollinated can move up to 10 to 12 miles. And so when you have a certified organic means zero GMO. Right. It's sort of, you know, it's not a balanced level playing field. It's kind of like, can the wolf coexist with a sheep? And the wolf's opinion, sure. You know, it loves lots of sheep. From the sheep, no. So in this instance, you know, organic agriculture being that, it, you know, the consumer expectation is zero GMO. Even though they're actually, according to the USDA standards, they do allow a 0.001% because we can never be absolute. But that's not coexistence per se. And I also had another instance of a corn seed crop that did get contaminated, and I had to destroy that crop, and that was back in 2011, and you know, and that the value went from a few thousand dollars to zero. So, again, you know, as we build an emerging industry, I'd like to see, you know, Josephine County and Jackson County is what comprised the Rogue Valley. Then we'd have a refuge that would be, you know, safe and free, because we look, most of the world, the good bottom land is all GMO crops. It's going that direction. So these little islands of coherence are increasingly valuable so that we can have the type of agriculture that can address climate change, you know, because I'm a plant breeder too. So we're, and that's where, you know, we can't do it all in greenhouses in some bubble. We're all on the same planet. So in our view in the organic industry as plant breeders, and I'm on the board of numerous seed advocacy organizations, and I teach plant breeding and seed growing widely around the country. We just don't see how coexistence can work. This isn't an ideological thing. It's a biological thing. You know, the rules of biology are that genes flow, pollen moves. They found beet pollen in jet airplane engines. So unless they've come up with some kind of bubble they can put over their GMO crops, I don't know how coexistence could work. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. Okay, let's have Craig Poe and Mike MacArthur, and let's have Barry Bashu, please.
Go ahead.
Craig. Mike, did you want to lead it off?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties. So the association is opposed to this legislation. We've taken a position that we don't feel that this is a proper role for county government to be engaged in. We don't have the technical expertise. We don't have the resources. This is a statewide issue. We think it ought to be handled by the Department of Agriculture. I simply point out, looking at the definition of genetically engineered means produced from one or more organisms that are vector-based recombinant deoxynucleic acid or ribonucleic acid techniques. So,
RNA.
Sorry, Mr. Principal, I couldn't deal with that. I don't know how many county folks can deal with that kind of definition. So, we stand back from the questions about GMO, but I hope that you recognize that this is a statewide concern matter.
Thank you. Craig?
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, I'm Craig Pope, Polk County Commissioner and First Vice President of Association of Oregon Counties. So I'm here to speak for Polk County and my constituents, a number of them behind me and lots of them watching on video. But I also would point to the last panel that was up here and talking about the complexities of separation. So I'm opposed to this bill, and I will continue to be opposed to every bill that tries to disrupt the state preemption. And we need to stay away from this as county governments or local governments, city governments as well. We simply do not have the resources. When you listen to, that was a great panel. They had some really great points to talk about there, and the complexities, it was global. I don't have the resources to do that. I'm trying right now to do all I can to keep my county afloat just to maintain the basic public services that are required of us as a local government. This is, as Mike said, a governance model that has to stay within state government. And we have the experts there. We have the generally appropriate funding to help those folks do that job and make certain that we work on the separation rules that are required for this. I am sympathetic to the organic community and the issues that they have, and I know it's an evolving industry, and we're an evolving state, and we're learning how to do this job correctly. But continuing to hammer at the preemption is not going to solve this problem. So we need to continue to fund the ODA and do our job there and work on this problem at that level. Thank you.
Barry.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Barry Bashu. I farm near Sandy, Oregon with my wife. We raise a large variety of vegetables and fruits and flowers. We have utilized conventional, biotech, and this spring are scheduled to plant our first organic crop on our small farm. I'm honored to be here as president of the Oregon Farm Bureau, representing the state's largest and only general agricultural farmer organization. In 2013, the legislature passed a seed preemption bill that clarified that the best choices for crop types and production methods should be made by farmers and not government. Unfortunately, this is an attempt to undo that and permanently put agriculture at risk. To let government stigmatize one crop over another and to pick winners and losers in the lottery that is farming is poor public policy and, at worst, destructive of the beauty that is Oregon agriculture. I was selected by Secretary Vilsack, Secretary of Agriculture, to serve on Agriculture and Biotechnology in the 21st Century Committee, along with 21 other members representing universities, agriculture, organic, conventional, and biotech farmers. All agreed on one common concept, which is that coexistence does, in fact, work, has worked, and will continue to work. Excuse me, I just lost my place here. I'm not very technologically savvy on this thing at the moment. Coexistence is not something new. It happens on small farms, big farms, and across fences. Our diversity is a testament to its success. I point to a nationwide survey of organic growers constructed by USDA and the National Agricultural Statistics Service. Growers were asked several questions about production and crops. Nationwide, only 1% of growers indicated any loss with regard to inadvertent presence of biotech. None of them were from Oregon. I point out that these were self-reported anonymously, and no evidence of any alleged loss was required. Less than 1% of all agricultural land in the U.S. is under organic cultivation and accounts for less than 5% of food sales. It is also my understanding that no growers have taken any advantage of USDA's mediation program. Farmers are willing to work with their neighbors and to collaborate with each other can work out planting dates and crop types to mitigate any potential challenges. Unfortunately, for some, it appears that banning their neighbor's crop is preferable to talking over fences. The destruction of GE crops in Jackson County was unforgivable. If demonizing our neighbors is a solution, we have a much bigger problem than this bill could ever address. I urge you to reject the notion that one farmer should be prioritized over another and to oppose this bill.
Okay, thank you, Barry. Actually, you just touched on something that I was going to ask. You know, the 2013 legislation did allow the election in Jackson County to stand, and I'm just wondering what, how is that going? Craig, I would ask you, in terms of what you're hearing from your colleague commissioners from Jackson County, are they in way over their heads in terms of being able to enforce it?
And Chair Denbrough, I to answer the last part of your question first, I would say I think yes, they would be. If you pinned them down, they would say yes, they're in way over their heads. And the bottom line is there's no funding stream ever identified in any of these bills that come forward trying to change the law. So again, in all due respect to folks behind me that are continuing to push for that, we need to have a way that we can actually pay for the professionals and the very science-based folks that we need to do this job. Jackson County doesn't have those people in place today. They're struggling with their budget just like my county is and every other county. Mike might have some other thoughts on this, where they are right now, but I haven't heard about any success stories for Jackson County.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding it's not based on recent information, but they simply didn't have the capacity to deal with this and are not dealing with it.
So the prohibition is not happening there?
It may be, but the county isn't taking any enforcement actions.
Okay.
I'm led to believe. I mean, I may be incorrect about that, but that's what I was led to believe.
Thank you.
Chair Denbrough, if I might,
from a
grower perspective, many of our growers were forced into removing crops or not planting crops for the future. They've been raising for a number of years, so it has had a negative impact on them.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, all three of you. Where are we? Griffin Gates, Andrew Schwartz, and Frank Horton, please. Okay, why don't you go in order, Griffin?
Hello, I'm...
Just pull that mic over, yeah.
Hi.
I get close to it, it's really sensitive.
I'm Giff Gates, I live in Grants Pass and I farm full-time. I'm here to represent the next generation of farmers. I'm also on the board member of the Southern Oregon Seed Growers Association. And while I can't represent the Josephine County Food Bank directly, as the farm manager of Raptor Creek Farm, which is a program of the food bank, I'm here on my own behalf. For about 10 years now, the food bank has partnered with certified organic seed growers to do a gleaning project. We have some growers who grow squash, organic seed squash, and they bring us the squash. We collaborate with volunteers to process the squash, and the food bank saves the meat. We distribute the meat out to our recipients through the food bank, and the seed growers go home with their squash seed, thousands of dollars worth of seed. This bill will support that effort, that community project that we do. Also, last year, I began growing organic seed crops as a fundraiser for the Josephine County Food Bank. In 2016, last year, I raised almost $5,000 as a fundraiser to help us grow more food for the recipients of the food bank. We focus on crops like squash, where we can glean the seed and the meat. This is a win-win situation. Senate Bill 1037 will directly support these efforts. And as a representative of the next generation of farmers, I'm deeply concerned with the monopolization and consolidation of the seed industry. The gentleman before us, I'm personally concerned about the state of where our agriculture are going with fewer and fewer people being in charge of the seed supply. So Senate Bill 1037 will support a diverse and robust seed economy, which we already have, and it will propel us into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Giff. Okay, Andrew.
Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Schwartz. I'm the president of the Southern Oregon Seagrowers Association, also known as NASASCA. We represent a group of farmers in Josephine and Jackson County who grow organic seed. The economic incentive for this has been growing for us, and so we find it very important to protect our investments. To get to the bottom line, coexistence is not an option for us. It's a one-way road. If there is contamination, our non-GMO seed is ruined, not only for the year, but permanently. There's no recovering that. On the other hand, the GMO seed is affected, or they can just reproduce it. So on that line, I find it very important to create these sanctuaries where, as a non-GMO seed producer, I can have the safety and assurances that my crop, my investment, my time, my energy, my livelihood will not be destroyed permanently, basically. So this is not necessarily an anti-GMO bill. It's putting the option back in the counties to create these sanctuaries where the seed can be produced for this generation, future generations, and to add diversity and resilience to our food supply. On that note, just allowing at least Josephine County to have the ability to have this sanctuary and complete the bioregion of the Rogue Valley as a world-class non-GMO seed-growing region. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
thanks to the committee for allowing us to speak on this.
And could you give us your name for the record?
My name is Frank Morton. I own and operate Wild Garden Seed at Shoulder to Shoulder Farm in Philomath in Benton County. As the record shows, I employ my family and 5 year-round full-time employees in my business. We send seeds all over the world to other seed companies for distribution. This includes to across the United States, Canada, Great Britain, France, and Australia. So we send a lot of seed out, and as other people have said, our customers expect our seed to be genetically coherent. I'm a member of the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, and I've served on the map pinning committee, so I understand these issues. I'm also a plant breeder. You can read my qualifications. I've studied this issue for a long time. So when the preemption bill was originally proposed, the Senate promised to take unspecified actions to support farmers needing the protection from the consequences of other farmers using genetically engineered crops. These consequences include cross-pollination, like people have mentioned, but they also include issues related to grass seed, which I don't hear anyone talking about. And I'm not going to have time to discuss that here. But the grass seed industry is just as imperiled by this advance in technology as organic farmers are. And I hope you read my testimony to understand that a little bit. While these topics can be more fully elaborated around the use of new technologies that bring in chemicals like dicamba, which is recognized by the Oregon Department of Agriculture as being a direct threat to the wine industry, ODA objected to the EPA's approval of this GE technology for use in our state. I hope you will consult with them about the issues around dicamba and grapes. But other issues, they all touch on exports.
I'm going to have to call you.
They all touch on exports.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As most of the folks that have come from Southern Oregon know that I've been listening about this issue for quite some time, and I'm always, you know, trying to validate and get more information. And I mean, that's how we make our decisions. Is,
yes.
And one thing, you know, and I'm a farmer myself, so. But one thing I've always wondered about is, you know, how does gardens? You know, we have a lot of gardens in our community, vegetable gardens. We've got other kind of gardens too, but we got a lot of vegetable gardens. I look at the seed, like, you know, at the Grange and stuff, and how do I know if that seed is GE, not GE, you know, or how do you know that?
The seed you buy in packets.
Yeah.
It has to be labeled.
If it's labeled organic, it's non-GMO.
Organic seed needs to be labeled.
Yeah, but
and genetically engineered seed also needs to be labeled.
Are you sure about that?
I believe so. You have to sign a contract saying you won't reproduce it. That's a good clue.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I have to investigate that more. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, though.
Yeah. I think I want to try to get as many people to testify as possible, but thank you. And you've submitted some testimony, right?
I did. Yeah. Actually, I submitted a sort of a abbreviated form. This testimony is a little bit expanded so you can understand my points a little better, if
okay.
I may.
Absolutely. Just this. Give it to Shelley over there. We'd welcome it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, all three of you. Okay, let's have Helle Rudenklaw, Roger Beyer, and Scott Dahlman, please. Helle, you want to start?
Yes. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is Helle Rudenklaw, and I'm here today to urge a no on Senate Bill 1037. My husband and I have a family farm in Yamhill and Polk counties, so we're impacted if there are different rules for different counties. We raise about 8 to 10 different crops each year, which includes both GE and non-GE crops. We are seed growers. That is our specialty. We are acutely aware of the requirements for seed purity and how to maintain those standards. For most seed crops, those requirements are laid out in the Certified Seed Handbook and with specifications for each type of certified seed produced in Oregon. If your neighbor plants a field the same type as yours, you may have to leave a buffer strip, which you have to handle and harvest and market separately from the rest. And that's a financial burden for us, but it's something that we know is just a cost of being a certified seed grower in Oregon. We deal with it. We don't argue with our neighbors about it. For other seed crops, the system's a little different. You heard about the pinning system that came into effect well before we started farming 25 years ago. And that voluntary cooperative system has worked remarkably well for many years. As you can see, there are already systems in place to protect specialty seed growers in Oregon. They have worked well over time, and they serve the needs of seed growers and protect their markets. The Oregon seed growers recognize the need to work together and coexist. And over time, we've proven we can do that without heavy-handed government intervention. If more protection is needed for a certain subsegment of growers, it should be brought up to the ODA. They are the agency equipped with expertise to handle that task. I request you do not pass this bill, which would negatively impact many specialty seed growers in Oregon by setting up a patchwork of local regulations and playing favorites to only one segment of Oregon's diverse agricultural industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here as the Executive Director of the Oregon Seed Council. We represent the seed industry in Oregon, and most specifically the grass seed industry in Oregon. So it has been mentioned that the GE bent grass issue will have a huge effect, and grass seed growers are concerned about GE bent grass in Oregon. I can tell you that as an association, we have never taken a position on the growing of GE bent grass, either for or against that particular industry. We believe in the seed preemption that we currently have in Oregon. That is officially the position of the Oregon Seed Council that supports seed preemption and keeping the regulation at the Department of Agriculture level. The two areas of the state that have experienced bent grass escapes, both the Far East Oregon, Malheur County, and Central Oregon, Jefferson County. In Jefferson County is a grass seed production area. And I can tell you from my conversations with farmers in that area, they do not support the removal of the seed preemption law. They support the current law as it stands today. They deal locally with the issue, and in Malheur County, they have also recently signed an agreement with the Scotts Company in order to deal with the issue on a local basis, and that's how they want it to happen. They don't want the county and the government to be involved in seed preemption. They want it at the state level. And that's so that's the official position of the Oregon Seed Council. I'm not going to try to tell you there aren't grass seed producers in the Willamette Valley who might benefit economically if there's a ban on a certain type of grass someplace or another. That's but we are not in a position here or at the Oregon Seed Council to pick winners and losers. That's the job of local farmers, as you heard, working together to sort out these issues in neighbor by neighbor. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Scott. Thank you, Senator Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Dahlman, Policy Director with Oregonians for Food and Shelter, speaking today in opposition to Senate Bill 1037 because it divides Oregon agriculture instead of promoting coexistence. We believe that Oregon's agricultural diversity is what makes it special. We have over 200 different commodities that are grown here using different methods, including conventional, organic, and biotech. And we think there's room for all of that. Because of this diversity, though, coexistence is key between these different crops. Farmers need to work with neighbors to ensure that everybody is able to grow the crops that work for their operation. Coexistence is possible. Farmers have had to coexist with neighbors for generations. Organic and GE are not unique in this. Even conventional growers of similar crops need to work together to avoid cross-pollination. And we support anything that supports that coexistence. We supported the mediation program at Department of Agriculture. We support the seed associations in the state that help promote that coexistence between growers. This bill does not promote that neighbors working together, but it pits one type of agriculture against the others. It has a built-in presupposition that GE crops are somehow more dangerous than neighboring neighboring crops and an other non-GE version of the same crop. This simply isn't true. Cross-pollination is a concern for seed growers regardless of if it is from GE or conventional plants. When growing seed, cross-pollination must be managed to ensure a seed will grow to type. And farmers can use different techniques to deal with this: pollination timing, physical barriers, and distance isolation. But this bill would take away a farmer's right to choose the crop that works best for them and puts local governments and voters in the position of picking winners and losers. It's not putting local farmers in charge of deciding how agriculture is handled in their community. It puts voters in charge. Land is immovable. If you're on a century farm and not in an area allowed to use GE crops, now you are disadvantaged against other growers in Oregon and nationally. So Senate Bill 1037 will only serve to divide Oregon's diverse agricultural community, and we urge your opposition.
Thank you, Scott. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, Ken Nook. Is that Keisha Huff? Something Huff? Kara Huff? Ms. Huff? Mary Alionis? Welcome, all three of you. Kent, you want to start us off?
Thank you for allowing us to give you our views. And we appreciate the time. My name is Kent Nock, and I am co-owner of Afternoon Zephyr Farm in Rogue River. I'm your constituent. And I have a PhD in geochemistry, and I have spent a lot of time in aerospace as an aerospace engineer. But now I'm a farmer. And being a chemist, I would like to talk to you about the adverse effects of chemical agriculture on soil and on food, but that's for another day. So what I would like to talk to you about is things that I have personal experience with, and coexistence seems to be a big word here today. I am also a member of SOSCA. I was a founding member of SOSCA, and I happened to sit beside a person at the meeting where that organization was founded, as close as I am to her. And the person was a corporate lawyer from St. Louis, Missouri. She did not work for Monsanto. She worked for Syngenta. And her goal at that meeting was to come and walk out of the meeting. She was there to hear what we were doing, and we were going to have one farmer, one vote. And she said, this does not fit with our business model. We want a vote for every plot that we have contracted. And they would have had more plots than we have members. So Saska stuck to its guns. They got up and walked out. That's coexistence, in their opinion. And I would also like to say that in Oregon, there are many diverse environments. And I miss the mountains here. But these little mountain valleys that we have are great for growing small lots of seed. And if you throw us in with the Willamette, you can't even see from one side of the valley to the other. I think that local people should decide what fits locally. And we're not going to be growing any full sections of wheat or corn in our valley. We want to grow little seed crops, which are highly profitable on a small scale. So we want local control. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Keisha, I'm sorry. Yes.
Thanks for your time. My name is Keisha Huff. I'm an organic farmer. I'm with Lupin Knoll Farm in Josephine County. Our farm is engaged in vegetable seed production and seed sales. We're also breeding new and tougher vegetable varieties for organic and for other growers. Top Hat corn, Texana corn, and Xanadu corn were developed at Lupin Knoll Farm and are all available now through multiple seed outlets. Our buyers are seed companies that specialize in organics, and the tolerance for genetically engineered content is zero. Other countries will provide GMO-free seed when we can't. Our farm has to pay for GMO testing to document that our seed is GMO-free in order to sell it, and that's expensive testing. If there's nothing to stop our neighbors from growing GMO corn, we run the risk of failing those tests. At that point, our business and all this breeding work that we're doing can't continue. Once GMO sequences are in the population, it's nearly impossible to get them back out. And it's not just corn. This year, engineered peepo squash is on the market, and for the first time, our heirloom pie pumpkins will need to be tested too. Some crops, like our cyber frills, kale, takes 2 years to produce seed, and the potential loss from contamination is really high. The Jackson-Josephine County line runs through the middle of the Rogue Valley, and pollen travels through the valley on wind and insects. You can't grow a crop that's GMO-free unless your whole neighborhood is GMO-free. The sensible boundary for a GMO-free area is the Rogue Valley watershed. So the question is not, are GMOs safe? The question is, should we permit a refuge where seeds without engineered genetics remain available? And should we place that refuge where the residents and farmers have already asked for it? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Keisha. Mary.
Hi, I'm Mary Eleonis. I've been farming in Southern Oregon since 1991. I currently have a farm and a store in Josephine County. I grow certified organic vegetables as well as organic seed crops, plus we lease land to beginning farmers to grow organic seed crops as well. On our farm in this coming season, we'll be growing corn, beet, and mustard seed, all of which are at risk for GE contamination from crops nearby. The Rogue Valley is home to a great many small-scale farmers, and it's a premier seed development and seed growing region, as Keisha just discussed. Our farms supply seed to many dealers. They sell to farmers and gardeners across the nation. At a point in time when a large portion of our seed supply is grown in other countries, the Rogue Valley stands out as a place to grow seed here in the U.S. As a farmer, I want to be able to use and grow seed in my country and not have to rely on imported seed, especially from countries that whose organic practices are perhaps suspect. When our two counties passed legislation to ban the planting of GE crops, we were poised to create a zone of more than 3,300 square miles free of GE pollen contamination. We're poised to create a zone where seed free of contamination could be close to guaranteed. To create this GE free zone in a region so well suited to seed production is massive. This is a major accomplishment for farming and organic farming in our entire nation. Since our two counties share waterways and share wind patterns, it's imperative that they both be GE-free zones. Josephine County is upwind of Jackson County. Jackson County is upstream of Josephine County. Our counties are intertwined. This is why both counties passed these measures. But our counties are also uniquely isolated from other counties by being encircled by multiple mountain ranges. This alignment of our two counties shows why it's imperative that the counties and communities statewide be able to make their own decisions on GE seed and cropping issues. This preemption of passage of Senate Bill 863 eliminated that right. This preemption was passed 3 years ago. Josephine County passed their measure nearly 3 years ago. Oregon State, the land of great scientists and resources, has not moved forward on this at all. I support this measure in the hopes of getting our county GMO-free. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
I've also included in your thing, this is showing our farms that supported this measure. This was both farms, both counties together supporting these measures in Josephine County and Jackson County. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Any questions,
colleagues? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And let me say, you know, we've reached the end of our time, and my colleagues have other commitments. I'll stay till 5:30 to try to take as much testimony for those of you who can stay to put it on the record. If you've submitted written testimony, of course, it's part of the record, but I'll stay till then. So thank you, all three.
Thank you. Yeah. Senator Denver, I'll stay with you probably to about 5:20. I got a 5:30, so okay. I'll hang around as long as I can.
Great. Thank you, Senator. Okay, Christina Arapalm. At some point, we'll move to a computer system or a thumbprint. Casey Cullough and Amy Van Son. Christina, you want to start?
Sure. Hi, I'm a vegetable grower.
Could you give us your name for the record?
Christina Arapalu. I'm a vegetable grower in Southern Oregon, and I'm in Jackson County, and we were able to vote on banning GE crops, and since then have become a seed sanctuary. And I'm on those. My farm is close to the border of Josephine and Jackson County, and so. You know, pollen doesn't know the borders of the counties. And so we've been just keeping an eye on what's going on with Josephine County, and we'd like to bring some young farmers onto our land to start growing seed crops. I know that being a seed sanctuary is bringing more young farmers an interest in growing seeds to our area. And I just believe that everybody, or each of the counties, because we have such unique, different farmland, and we should have the right to choose what's right for our individual counties. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Casey Kula. We have a farm. My wife and I have a farm, certified organic fruit, tree fruit and vegetable farm, just north of here on Grand Island. So we're Yamhill County residents. And thanks. We have spent a lot of time, my wife Katie and I, on the issue of aggregate because we're on a river island. So we've spent some time here talking about Goal 5 a lot. But what I really think is that county decision-making can work. We have a lot of examples. Recently, with Measure 91, we said, counties, you get to decide whether you want to opt in or want to opt out. And people, counties have done that. And that seems to be working for the marijuana regulated industry. So much time. So what people talk about with seed sanctuaries or with pinning is essentially an isolation. And if we can just think of Jackson and Josephine counties as being one big isolation, I don't see the problem. The root and claws can farm in Yamhill and Polk County. They can have GE pollen all over the place. I can't say anything about it, but that's okay because there's an isolation down there that we've all agreed on. Third, school boards are a great example of counties and municipalities and districts making decisions that aren't mandated by the state. There's a little bit of a regulatory oversight, but counties and cities still get to make the decisions locally. Picking winners and losers? Who's doing that? What happens? Oh, nice, 20 seconds. Okay, so what happens when the neighbor-to-neighbor, farmer-to-farmer relation breaks down? Because it does, right?
Yeah.
All the time.
Casey,
even with our best friends. Okay, sorry. So just think about that. We do need regulatory bodies to talk about these things, like the county, when the farmer-to-farmer relations break down. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Dembro. My name is Amy Van Son, and I'm an attorney with the Center for Food Safety. And we've been working on the issue of genetic engineering at CFS for 2 decades, and so we consider ourselves somewhat experts on the regulation of GE crops. And I can tell you that the federal regulation is extremely lax and non-existent when it comes to the harms, the socioeconomic harms from contamination and environmental harms from GE crops when they're approved and commercialized. And so USDA has said, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has agreed, that it's states and local governments who should be addressing transgenic contamination as a very real threat. Contamination has cost billions of dollars to U.S. farmers, and Oregon farmers are no strangers to it, as you can see. And I would like to point out that, you know, there is no coexistence when the burden only flows to one side, when only the people who do not grow GE have to try to fence it out. There's you know, they take the entire burden. It's really contrary to, you know, decades, centuries of property law. I also want to point out that the bans that we've seen in many counties in Oregon, but is also California, they're pretty self-enforcing. When you have to sign a contract to be able to grow a GE crop, you know, the corporations selling those are probably not going to want to sell them to people in counties where it's illegal. I don't know of any costs that any counties have had to spend to enforce these laws. And I would also just wrap up by adding that just because the local governments will have their hands untied to take steps if they should be taken does not mean that the state cannot also use its power that this legislature has said it has in 2013 to do something to protect farmers. It can be both. Like was said, you can have state setting a floor, counties doing something different. Ideally, that's what would happen, but ODA has shown no signs of wanting to do that, and they're very clear about that. So I'd encourage you to please review my written testimony, and thank you again for having us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
Thanks all three. Barbara Richard, Sandra Bishop, and I'm sorry,
Dr.
Reed
Feidler.
Sure, sure.
Elise Higley, maybe? She's more than 100 miles.
No, no. I think I got all the...
No, we have... This person.
We've got one more.
Oh. Okay. I'm sorry, Elise. I didn't...
This morning, I'll do another 4 hours back, no. So I'm just going to come on out.
Yeah. I have a couch upstairs, at least, if you'd like to know. Yeah. Whoever wants to start, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, and remaining committee member.
Thank you.
My name is Barbara Richard, and I traveled from Ashland in support of SB 1037. According to the USDA, in a survey that was published last year, Oregon ranks fourth in the nation in dollars of organic sales, $269 million annually. And that's a double-digit increase from the previous year. Oregon is one of the world's premium seed-growing regions. Oregon farmers are well-positioned to continue to benefit from this economic opportunity, in particular, those who grow organic seed crops, which are in high demand. However, right now, Oregon farmers' organic seed crops are at risk. The state has had 4 years to implement some protections against GE contamination, but has done nothing. So now is the time to act to restore local control and allow local communities to protect these seed crops from contamination by genetically engineered crops. The future of this industry in Oregon is in your hands. Also, please keep in mind that this bill costs the state nothing. Cross-pollination happens. It's how biology works. Let's take action today for the bounty of tomorrow and support SB 1037. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, committee members. Thank you for sticking it out. Wow. I'm Ray Seidler. I live in Ashland, and I'm here to support 1037. Way back, I was a professor of microbiology at Oregon State University, and I wrote the first ever national research plans to evaluate the safety of genetically engineered organisms. I then joined the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as a senior research scientist, and I put those plans into action. Let's start. The USDA definition for successful coexistence is concurrent cultivation of diverse agricultural crops consistent with, one, underlying consumer preferences, and two, farmer choices. They got to get together, right? So I won't bore you with the details. We don't have the time. But listen, you know that bentgrass coexistence was a miserable failure in Idaho and Oregon. Coexistence works? I'm sorry. Alfalfa, you know, Southern California and Washington State, another failure of coexistence. Canola, surely you know. You addressed the issue a few years ago right in this legislature. And let me just go on to corn, and that'll be it. Last crop year, Syngenta GE yellow corn for ethanol production cross-pollinated a neighbor's farm in Nebraska. This ruined the equivalent of 25,000 bushels of white corn that was destined for flour, and it ruined it biochemically and economically. There are over 400 other reports in the literature of the failure of coexistence. So when the USDA claims GE crops are safe, know that that means they just simply don't contain DNA from a pest. It has nothing to do with the safety declaration regarding cross-pollination. Farmers need your help. Farmers need your help to protect their higher value crops because coexistence does not work. The scientific evidence and growing consumer preferences justify support of 1037. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Elise?
Hello, my name is Elise Higley. I am a farmer in Southern Oregon, Applegate Valley, and I'm also the director of Our Family Farms. I represent thousands across Oregon who are also concerned about our traditional seed supply. One, I want to say that, you know, I think many have said today this is not a pro or anti-GMO bill. This is actually a really simple bill that just puts the decision-making power back in the local agricultural communities for GE seed decisions and contamination issues like it's been for 150 years. However, when people talk about neighbor to neighbor and farmer getting along and a handshake, genetically engineered crops have not been around for decades and decades. They are still very new, and this is a new thing that we're trying to figure out. But what we have figured out is that coexistence does not work when you're farming seed. And so that's what our biggest concern is right now, is looking at our traditional seed supply. As people mentioned, you know, 80% of the seed supply in the world is owned by the three large chemical companies in the world. This is a very scary thought when you're a farmer. We've lost 90% of the varieties of our seeds in the last 50 years. We are farmers here asking for your protection and your help. And we are saying we are concerned about traditional seed supply. We see a huge demand. We see the boom in rural developments. You've gotten letters from companies that have, you know, billions or millions and millions asking, even in just your district alone, saying we need to support the organic seed industry. And we have this huge demand, but the problem is our seed supply is getting less and less. And one of the reasons it's getting less is because of the GE threats. And we need to do what we can to protect them. The state has shown that they don't care or they're not willing to address the issue. The solution is to go back to the way we've been since the foundation of Oregon and to let the local communities address their agricultural needs. And the beauty of it is it costs the state nothing to do it, and it costs the counties nothing. Every single county that has passed an ordinance has never had a violation, and that's because you have to sign a legal binding contract to plant GE seeds, and it would be null and void. These chemical companies are not idiots. They're not going to lose money by having somebody illegally sign a document in a county where it's banned. So thank you for your support in the bill. You know, the future of our seed supply is really at your hands, and we're asking to please allow us to come up with some solutions. Thank you for your time, and I really appreciate you saying later.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I brought some GMO-free corn seed. It's not worth more than $50, or it could be if you guys don't let us keep the seed sanctuary. But this was raised in Jackson, Josephine County, and you can keep it as a collectible item if you don't pass the bill.
So. Now, don't give us incentives there.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
No, actually, why don't you give it to... Okay, can we have Lisa Ierney and Sabrina Riggs, please?
Where are we at, Senator?
We're close.
Okay, because I got about three more minutes, so.
I think we can do it in 3 minutes.
Welcome.
Is this it? Is this
long? No. But thank you.
Chair Dembro, Senator Bartschiger. For the record, my name is Sabrina Riggs. I am here representing the Oregon Seed Association. We are also known as OSA. OSA is a nonprofit agricultural trade association that represents the interests of Oregon's world-renowned seed industry. Included in OSA's membership are 46 seed companies that are spread across the state. I'm here today to state OSA's opposition to Senate Bill 1037. Genetically engineered crops are already strictly and closely monitored by the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. Deregulated GE crops have been determined to pose no plant pest risk to the environment. Additionally, OSA has already adopted a stewardship policy to proactively establish policies for the cultivation of GE crops. We have submitted a copy of this policy as written testimony. You can find it under my name on OLIS. OSA's objective for deregulated GE crops or for biotechnology is to follow a policy of coexistence. Our members already voluntarily agreed to policies, positions, and communications that enhance peaceful coexistence. OSA is well known around the United States and around the world as a professional organization. We are concerned that this bill allows local governments to create a hodgepodge of regulations for GE crops across the state. Farmers often own land in multiple cities or counties, and sometimes they can farm a single field can span across city or county borders. This bill would be very, very difficult for them to comply with. We would like to ask for your opposition to Senate Bill 1037, and I can take any questions if there are any.
Thank you very much, Sabrina.
Chair Dembro and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Arney, and I'm a past president of the OSA, the Oregon Seed Association. Our association's been around for over 48 years, and I'm here to express opposition to Senate Bill 1037. I grew up on a grass seed production farm in Albany in the center of the Willamette Valley, and I've been selling grass seed for about the past 37 years. As it's been stated, there are APHIS is in charge, the USDA is in charge of watching these crops, the genetically engineered crops. These crops can produce a more bountiful yield in less than ideal conditions and on less acreage. As my friend here said, many farmers cultivate land in multiple cities that can cross county lines, city lines, and would make it impossible for those farmers to comply with individual patchwork regulations. I would like to liken it to, I don't know, you guys, baseball fans, football fans, there's rules to those competitions, right? So let's take those teams, and let's say each team has their own set of rules. And then within those teams, then the individual players have their own set of rules. You're gonna have a chaotic race or a chaotic competition. And that's what the Senate bill is proposing. It's proposing this patchwork of regulatory things that we have, that the farmers would have to deal with. This bill provides production areas and those farmers across the U.S. and the globe an advantage over our Oregon farmers. Passage of this bill would be putting our state and our Oregon farmers at a huge disadvantage.
Okay. Thank you very much, Nancy.
Senator, I have to, but for anybody that is going to continue to testify, I'm going to come into the office early tomorrow and watch it on tape.
I think you. We may just have one more panel, so... You may miss the best, Senator. Okay.
But I do promise I will watch it on tape in the morning. Thanks, everybody, especially for coming from Southern Oregon. I know it's at least a three-hour drive. See you later.
Okay. Jonathan Gunn. Lucinda Heights-Clayburg. And Ivan Molesky.
Is there any other farmers?
Yeah,
this farmer.
Jonathan, welcome. Sorry to keep you waiting.
No, thanks for sticking around. So my name's Jonathan Gunn. I'm a organic seed farmer in Provolt in Southern Oregon, Josephine County. And I won't repeat a lot of what's already been said by my fellow farmers, but just want to make a few quick points. The demand for organic seed right now is so great that we can't keep up with the supply in the United States. So as a beginning farmer, this is really important for me. In our valley, the market for fresh vegetables is fairly saturated. So growing seeds for mail order companies in other parts of the country is a really economically viable thing for me as a beginning farmer. You see a lot of the headlines about the median age of farmers in this country being up in the 60s and not a lot of young people wanting to move into farming. But there is a lot of us. We just need to find a way to make it make sense financially. So growing organic seed is that for me and my fiance. So with this ban in place, I wouldn't have to worry about losing a year's worth of work because of cross-contamination. And it would allow me to create a business for the county and eventually jobs as I scale up. So it'd be a very good thing for the county and for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name's Lucinda Heights Claybaugh.
You can stay back.
Sorry. And I live in Forest Grove. On my just under half acre, I am a gardener, an organic gardener, not really a farmer. But on my intensively planted organic property, I do grow organic kiwis, organic persimmons, organic five types of apples, two types of pears, the three types of plums. I can go on. I very intensively garden what I garden, and I sell it locally at my local farmers market and in sometimes even in the city. People want my niche market. I'm small, but it's a niche market, and I understand how important it is that people get properly tilth certified, that they actually have contracts signed by people, and that people who are going for genetically engineered products instead are a great danger to those of us that are trying to keep things as clean and pure as we can. I have to go down the street and talk to my neighbors so that I don't have drift. And that's just a local municipal thing, but as a small person, I may try to do my local municipal changes to match what Josephine County and Jackson are trying to do. I want a sanctuary where I am. I don't want them destroying my crops. So we need to stop Monsanto, Dow, Bayer, DuPont, Syngenta, all of these companies with vested interest in making money are buying our politicians at ODA, Oregon Farm Bureau, folks who really are supposed to be working for the sake of organic farmers and sustainable crops. I'd like to see us think about GMOs differently. If we don't have the cooperation of those people, then they need to be replaced. And we need to start thinking drift and the damage it does. Thank you.
Thank you. Ivan, hello.
Chair Dumbrough, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky, the policy director with Friends of Family Farmers. I want to thank you for staying late today to hear the testimony, and I'd like to thank all the farmers who came, especially from long distances today, because this issue is so important, and it needs a resolution by the legislature this session. That's why we're here today. I've submitted lengthier written testimony, so you can review that. I'll keep it brief. I served on Governor Kitzhaber's task force on genetic engineering a few years ago. That was actually an outgrowth of the preemption bill passed in the special session of 2013. At the time, the clear intent, if you look back at the record of that preemption, was that there would be some sort of a statewide approach. But at the time, we opposed that because we felt that unless there was some clarity given to the Department of Agriculture on what to do and how to do it, that there would be no state action. And in effect, what the legislature did back then was create a policy vacuum. And so we now have a preemption on local communities from protecting farmers, and we essentially have a vacuum in which the state of Oregon, the Department of Agriculture, says it has no authority to protect farmers. And so this is a conflict that needs to be resolved. And so what this bill is about today is it's not trying to dictate or mandate a statewide approach. It is trying to allow local communities to move forward with locally supported initiatives. And so at a minimum, you could hear that in Josephine County and Jackson County, you have a lot of strong support for these types of protections. And so what this bill would do would allow that the broader two-county protections to go into place, and it would allow local communities to have these conversations in the future. And so, you know, this bill is good for rural Oregon. It's good for local control, and we urge you to support it with a do-pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ivan. Let me pose to you the question that I posed to the to the Farm Bureau, and that is, what is your sense of the experience in Jackson County, which has had this for a few years? Do you have members down there?
Chair Dembro, yes, we do.
And how's it working? I mean, you know, in a sense, it turned out to be a pilot project.
Chair Dembro, that I think that's fair. It's by all accounts, we've heard it to be a great success for the growing and burgeoning, frankly, organic seed industry. A number of the growers have come up today are within a group called the Southern Oregon Specialty Seed Growers Association. And so I think you're seeing a lot of investment in that community down there. You see some of the testimony you've seen today in writing is from some of the state's largest organic companies, like Organically Grown Company out of Eugene that works with a lot of Southern Oregon farmers. And so to my understanding, there were a couple of conflicts early on with some farmers who had some perennial crops, alfalfa, that are long term, but those were ultimately settled in a court process, and that process allowed those folks to have time to be accommodated. So, but it's my understanding that it's been quite a success down there. That even those small number of farmers that had some legitimate issues with perennial crops have been allowed to sort of transition over time, and I think in a very fair and just way. And ultimately, it's my understanding that the courts have determined that what happened in Jackson County is actually consistent with Oregon's right to farm. I think that's very significant, because you can craft these types of resolutions and have it be consistent with Oregon's right to farm and the right of farmers to grow without the fear of their property lines being crossed by something they don't want. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Oh, I never heard from Sandra. Did you want to testify? No?
No, sir.
Okay. Well, we got through the whole list. So thank you all for your patience. It's fine. So I'll be closing the public hearing on this and consulting with my colleagues about next steps for this. But I really appreciate the testimony, the tenor of the testimony, and you know, the way that you were able to address this, looking at it in terms of region and geography and, you know, the notion of a rogue valley. I think that was, you know, for those of you who are proponents of this bill, I think you articulated it well. Those of you who had concerns and continue to have concerns about the bill, you know, it really does address that core question. Is it best to have a single policy that applies statewide, or can you have a single policy that applies statewide that includes the possibility of regional variation? I think that's something that, you know, we have to wrestle with as policymakers. So with that, anyway, thank you for, I think, a great hearing. So I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill, and I'm going to carry it over, the work session on it, over until tomorrow. I have to also carry over, Senate Bill 1007 and Senate Bill 1048. And having carried over everything I had to carry over, we are adjourned. Carry over, we are adjourned.